Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Gregory Melville and Susan Fox and Kathleen Bromage.
This week on The Wheelhouse, 2023. Looking back and then ahead to 2024. For Connecticut Public, I'm Frankie Graziano. This is The Wheelhouse, the show that brings the politics to the people. We got your weekly dose of politics in Connecticut and beyond, right here in Hartford, Connecticut. An annual dose of politics. You know, a lot of things happened in Connecticut and beyond nationally in 2023. You and I can buy cannabis now in Connecticut. There's also been some regulation of that as well. With the advent of the legal cannabis market in Connecticut, was supposed to come what's called a clean slate, which is the automatic erasure of criminal convictions. That's something we want to get into tonight. We've got what we call a powerhouse panel to join us on the Wheelhouse Live tonight. We got the powerhouse panel. We're going to talk about cannabis convictions. We're going to also talk about gun violence prevention in Connecticut and beyond. We're also going to talk about affordability and the cost of living in Connecticut. You know, I've been teasing this special guest for about a month or so now. So let's not waste any more time. We're going to bring out our surprise guest, ladies and gentlemen, the 89th governor of the state of Connecticut, Governor Ned Lamont. On the Wheelhouse Live.
Hey, Frankie.
That's a pretty good approval rating,
That's
I think.
That's pretty good.
Everybody's talking about ratings and things like that lately. That sounded like a standing ovation.
How about a powerhouse guest and a surprise panel? There's another way to say it.
Oh, well, I should have probably hid the panelists beforehand, though. What do you think? We got Ali on set here tonight. You've already met Ali. You were gracious enough to take a picture with Ali earlier when we sent them out to promote the show.
You've got your tentacles everywhere, is that it? But they're not tentacles, you told me.
That's right. They're arms. So octopuses have 8 arms, right, audience? Not tentacles. I have to be very particular about these things because I'll get emails. But nonetheless, we do have a great show tonight. We thank the governor for coming here, Governor Ned Lamont. All right, so we're in the recreational marijuana business now in Connecticut. So revenues, if we're looking at them across the first year here, basically, in Connecticut since it launched last January, up every single month. So how do you think the cannabis market is going in Connecticut, the adult use cannabis market? What do you think?
Wrong question.
Oh, yeah?
Look, we're surrounded by states that have legalized marijuana. I thought that driving folks who are smoking to the underground market where it's dangerous, laced with fentanyl, was the wrong way to go. I thought a regulated market would be a safer market. So that's really what drove our decision when we did it. You're right that folks are buying marijuana, buying it legally. We have about $40 million. I hope that money that we've raised with taxes is going to go to daycare and homelessness in those communities that were hardest hit by the war on drugs. We're making progress there. We're doing it safely and carefully.
So you're pretty happy with the launch overall, you'd say?
I think so, yeah. Yeah.
We talked about, I talked about clean slate in the open. It's something I wanted to follow up on you on. Do you guys think that's something you could take care of maybe here in 2024? I think it's trying to work the
Here's
system
the
to try to
clean
make sure.
Slate. There are a lot of folks that got convicted for marijuana laws that are now no longer illegal. These would sit on people's records for most of their life, making almost in many ways, making it a life sentence. We just didn't think that was right or fair, especially given the change of law. So for all those misdemeanor penalties after a period of time, good behavior, those are wiped clean.
44,000 convictions, something like that.
That's cleared. Exactly right.
What about the rest of them? You think you can get there in the next year or so, something like that?
What do you mean the rest of them?
There's still some convictions I think they got to get cleared, correct?
There's some low-level felonies that I think we're also going to take a look at, and they take a little longer to adjudicate. We're going to honor the deal we made when we passed the legislation, absolutely.
When you passed the legislation, you just talked about the drug wars. It was all about giving opportunity to people that were impacted by the drug war. So are you seeing that? Is the social equity piece coming together the way you guys thought it would?
I think so. Social equity in the sense that folks who are convicted, it's not a life sentence, and we're getting them back on their feet. We're giving them job training. We're giving them an opportunity to get on with their life, which I think is the right thing to do. There is some tax revenues for it. I said we're going to target that in those communities that are hardest hit by the war on drugs. I think that we're doing the right thing.
Something else that people talk about when they talk about cannabis and it being legalized in Connecticut, some folks, including people across the aisle, some Republicans like Vinny Candelora, or at least some Republicans also on the Transportation Committee, they're worried about people driving while they're high. Is that something that's actually happening to a big degree in Connecticut? What are you seeing? What's the administration seeing?
I could tell you that coming out of COVID, there's a lot of incredibly extreme behavior. People are driving like a bat out of hell. a lot of that
you're getting
is,
some claps for
some
that.
Of that is mental health. Some of that is social media. Some of that is driving while intoxicated. You put all that together, it's a toxic mix. You know, I talk to the cops. I spend a lot of time with state police. They won't let me drive. And, you know, but they do say when we stop somebody, it's the whole panoply of things that is often what's getting up.
We're looking at state governments and what they're trying to do. President Joe Biden has said, even in the last campaign season, and then when he was elected, that they want to make sure that cars are pretty much zero emission by 2035. It's something that you've been trying to do in Connecticut. How are we going to get there? So the regulations had to be withdrawn recently. So how are we going to get to that point where nobody's selling new gas vehicles in 2035?
We're not rushing into this.
Sure.
A legislature passed it unanimously in 2004. That was a while ago. They passed it 2/3 majority less than 2 years ago. We're making incredible progress when it comes to EVs and hybrids. We've reduced the price by well over 1/3 in the last couple of years. Now very competitive, the internal combustion engine with credits. And they're going much further than they were before. And we're up to about 11% of our car sales are now related to EVs. And also, don't forget the hybrids. The hybrids will continue to be sold. For those folks who have range anxiety or in an urban area where they're not positive they're going to have all the charging stations, you've always got that as an option going forward as well. Look, I think it's the right thing to do. I think it's a North Star. It's a goal. It's 2035. We got about 40% of the rest of the country heading that way. And I hope the legislature doesn't change their mind.
I'm going to start jumping around here in the last couple of minutes here to make sure that we get a lot of things
in here. Last couple of minutes, we just started.
I know, right? Doesn't it feel like? So let me give you a few more minutes then. But affordability, that's something that you really care about. We just had this tax law that was passed. I think something like $600 million in tax cuts was what the administration was touting. The largest tax cut since the personal income tax was implemented in 1991. Tell me a little bit about that, and I guess when people could start seeing some breaks in their paychecks.
Starting on January 1st, all working families, middle-class families, people earning up to about $250,000 a year will see about a $50 a month cut in their taxes. That'll be right there in your paycheck.
Are you getting some claps for that, Gov?
A little different
with the
than
live audience.
Yeah, a little different than Trump. He, cuts taxes for these folks. I'm cutting taxes for most people. But more broadly, it's about making this state more affordable. I really care about that deeply. Some of that's related to taxes. Some of that's related to expanding daycare and childcare, making it easier for you to raise your family and get back to work. Some of that's related to job training and debt-free community college. These are all ways we can make Connecticut a little more affordable. I think it's working. You know, we had 58,000 new folks move into the state of Connecticut last year. Remember 10 years ago, all the moving vans, everybody's leaving for New York City or Florida. Now they've turned around and they're coming back, and I think that's one of the reasons.
Republicans, people probably having houses fall on them while they try to buy houses on the housing market because it's so expensive. They might be asking about the cost of inflation. Could there be more cuts down the line, maybe next year or the year after? What's the administration thinking there?
I'm careful. I hate to overpromise and underdeliver. We've been promising big things, not getting it done. We got this tax cut done. We've got our budget has been balanced for 5 years in a row. We're making investments in folks most in need. We're expanding educational opportunity. I think we're going to slow down a little bit for the next year or so, make sure we're digesting all the things we've done, make sure we keep having a balanced budget.
It's like I got you on the hot seat here where we're jumping around a little bit, probably because these lights are so hot. So I'm sweating a little bit. Sorry if I got a little sweat on my brow. Governor looks fine. I don't think he's sweating while answering these questions. Let me jump now to gun violence prevention. And some of the things that you were targeting last year, or at least earlier this year, assault weapons that were grandfathered in beyond the 1994 U.S. guns bill, ghost guns, at least trying to strengthen regulation around that, open carry. So what do you think about that effort and more ways going forward, I guess, to continue tackling gun violence?
I think it's working. I think if you're not serious about gun safety and getting those illegal guns off the street, those plastic ghost guns off the street, if you're not serious about red flag laws and making sure people who have addiction or violence issues make sure they can't get their guns, you're not serious about law and order. And I'm proud that Connecticut, broadly speaking, is continuing to take a lead on this. And frankly, it works. Everybody, I like things that work. We have strict gun safety laws, and our gun crimes are much less than they are in Georgia and Mississippi and all those places that lecture us and say these gun safety laws don't work. They do. You're safer for it.
I'm going to let you get that. You're getting some claps there. You said Mississippi, and it reminded me of the fact that we just had pretty much some landmark legislation where we finally were able to have in-person voting, because in Connecticut, we were one of only four states that didn't allow that. So that's going to happen rather soon. But now, in the next election in November, there's going to be a referendum around no-excuse absentee balloting. So what do you think is going to happen there? Do you think that's going to pass?
I think that's going to pass. Remember, we did that during COVID where we didn't want everybody lined up for hours. And we had a very successful election. More people voted with integrity. I think that's where we want to go. I think we've been a little slow as a state in making it easier for people to vote. And despite Bridgeport, we do it pretty safely. We do it with integrity.
I got 30 seconds or less on just this point alone. Tell the people that are here, and maybe people in Bridgeport, January 23, they have that next election. Have you, at the state level, I know that Stephanie Thomas is working on it. Should people be confident that that's going to go the right way on the 23rd?
I think so. Look, there's a little bit of a history there that makes me nervous. We've had cameras there in each and every one of those voting boxes for the absentee ballots. We have a special monitor down there. And I think Bridgeport wants to prove everybody wrong. They want to show that they can get it right. There's a bit of a cloud there right now, and I think they're going to get it right in January 23rd. Is that when the primary is? And going forward, it's really important. I got to make sure that people have confidence in these elections. You know, there's a former president that casts a lot of shadow on our democracy. We're not going to let that happen in Connecticut.
I think we're going to ask you and your team to get out there before the election, because you just rallied all these folks, and maybe none of them, I don't even know if they vote in Bridgeport, but you got them all excited. Ladies and gentlemen, the 89th governor of the state of Connecticut, Ned Lamont, thank you so much.
That's
Governor. Thank you so much,
That's
Governor,
it,
for coming
Thanks,
on
Frankie.
The Wheelhouse Live. Stay here for a second. I do want to tease our next segment. I'm going to give you a gift in a second.
Thanks, guys.
Stay tuned, as we're going to have a powerhouse panel join us. We talked about 2023 with the governor. We'll break down what he just said. We'll talk about 2023 in Connecticut. And let's go into 2024 after that. You're listening to The Wheelhouse on Connecticut Public.
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford HealthCare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford HealthCare. A lot of people struggle with sleep apnea and with CPAP machines. Dr. Carl Muller, a head and neck surgeon with Hartford Hospital, describes Inspire, a surgical alternative to the CPAP approach.
Only about 60% of patients can tolerate CPAP real well. Inspire is a surgical alternative to CPAP. It's an outpatient surgery. It takes about 2 hours. And essentially what it does is it picks up when you're taking a breath and sends a 2-second electrical pulse to the tongue, which causes the tongue to stick out a little bit and stiffen and prevent the airway from collapsing.
Hartford Hospital has performed more than 200 Inspire therapy surgeries. If you've tried and failed with CPAP, you could be a candidate for this minimally invasive procedure.
Patients with moderate to severe sleep apnea are candidates. There is a weight criteria, so you have to have a body mass index below 35, and you have to have tried and failed CPAP.
To learn more, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
This is The Wheelhouse from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Frankie Graziano. In case you missed it, you're tuning in to The Wheelhouse. We just had a live surprise interview with the governor of the state of Connecticut. Thank you so much to the governor for coming on. I also want you to be aware of our backing if you're listening to this. We do have some great fans in attendance in Hartford, including some great friends from Danbury in the front row who are rather loud and boisterous. You're going to hear some cheers, jeers, whatever throughout this, but this audience has been great and they've been respectful. And now they're going to give it up for our powerhouse panel. Joining me first is Susan Raff, Chief Political Reporter, Eyewitness News, WFSB Channel 3.
Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is all mine. Mark Pazniokas, Capitol Bureau Chief, Connecticut Mirror.
Good evening.
Such a wealth of knowledge on this panel. I'm so lucky to tap into them, as well as Bilal Siku, the doctor, the Hillier College Associate Professor of Politics and Government at the University of Hartford.
Go Hawks.
There you have it, the Hartford Hawks.
Go Hawks.
All right, so the powerhouse panel is now in session. We just heard from the governor. Susan, I'll let you go first. Give me some reaction to what I was talking about with the governor. What was a talking point that you came away with?
Well, I think you wanted to recap kind of the marijuana, you know, changes in our state, and it is a little bit different from what the rest of the country is doing with equity, but there is a concern. Police departments have seen an increase in buzz driving in their communities, and there aren't a whole lot of measures in the field to address that. So it's positive in the sense that it does generate some income for the state, and it gives people in disadvantaged communities a leg up, but it does come with, you know, some issues.
Mark, what were your reactions to what the governor said or what Susan said? What do you got?
The governor is not budging one inch on fiscal issues. I think he has made it clear to everybody who's here he's still sticking to the game plan that got him reelected by 13 percentage points.
Are you talking about fiscal control?
I'm talking about when you asked him about, you know, perhaps further tax cuts, and he was, you know, very careful. He is, I think, he has indicated here tonight and earlier that he's going to stick to, again, his fundamental message that got him reelected by such a large margin, which is to go slowly and carefully on protecting the state's finances.
Dr. Siku, what do you got?
Well, there were two things that stood out to me that I really appreciated. One was the discussion around second chance. I think, you know, certainly with what happened with the war on drugs and the criminalization, especially in communities of color with mass incarceration, I hear the governor, you know, really talk about how Connecticut made a great step forward with trying to do something about trying to rectify that injustice was really important to me. The second piece, as you know, I care a lot about elections and voting in terms of teaching political science at the University of Hartford.
You got a clap there from one of our audience members.
That's right.
Also, you know, on the board of Common Cause.
Exactly. So to hear the governor, you know, talk about the success around early voting, and also hear the governor say that he thinks that no excuse absentee voting will pass this year, which is something that at Common Cause, and we're really working on that issue, and so I'm happy to see that the governor seems to be in favor of having that happen.
Let's go to elections. I got to talk about it really quickly with the governor. I didn't have a lot of time. I wanted to have more time with the governor. He's been gracious. I think he's still here. The governor's been terrific here, but the show is what it is, unfortunately. But we got to talk a little bit about Bridgeport. We got to talk about allegations of ballot stuffing in Bridgeport that have led Republican lawmakers in the state, I guess some national voices as well, to criticize maybe not just the way that elections were held in Bridgeport, but maybe absentee ballots on the whole. So, Bilal, is this kind of like an isolated incident, what's alleged to have happened in Bridgeport, or should there be some kind of bigger issue that some of these Republican lawmakers are making?
In the time that I've been here in Connecticut, there are certain things I think we can rely on. The sun rising in the east, setting in the west, and Bridgeport having problems with this election.
He said it.
You know, so it didn't come as a surprise in that particular sense. And so certainly things need to be done down there in Bridgeport with this, you know, special election is coming up, primary coming up, and then maybe election afterward. But in general, I think, you know, the take-home story for me about Connecticut elections, especially given the national discussion about elections being stolen and all of the problems and the lack of trust, was just how smooth our elections actually went in this state.
You
and that's a statement about the
success of Connecticut. You have 169 towns, and, you know, Bridgeport was really one bad apple. All the primary elections and the general elections, things went fine. And if you look at the system as a whole, you had cameras on those ballot boxes in Bridgeport. So the system worked. They caught people, and now we're seeing the investigation. So I think some cities and towns actually have taken a look. Enfield, for example, added more cameras, better ones, directly pointed at their ballot box. So it's a lesson for everyone. But you can't necessarily say that the whole system is corrupt.
I got to go to you on one thing. We're going to finish up this topic in a second. So we have an election on the 23rd. The state is trying to put some safeguards in place with help from the mayoral candidates involved. So what measures are going to be in place, and is this going to be something that people could be confident in, Mark? All the pressure in the world asking you it. Good luck with that one.
The challenge, you know, they had an election monitor, but it's kind of a misnomer. The monitor is not hanging out watching people fill out their absentee ballots. It's a question of
stamping
counting.
It too. Yeah.
And so Connecticut has very strict laws about who can handle an absentee ballot. Now, if people are intent on breaking the law, they're going to break the law. But the significance of Connecticut's strict law, which says only certain people can handle that ballot. I mean, I can turn in a ballot for my children, and you can have a police officer, you can have somebody who's designated. That's it. But that's the significance of that law is those two women who were shown repeatedly depositing ballots. The burden is going to be on them to show where's the paperwork that you got to handle that many ballots. So Connecticut actually has pretty good law to protect that. You can, again, no law can be written to stop the bad behavior, but it can be written to make it easier to catch somebody and prosecute.
And a great track record of actually prosecuting people who do things that are wrong, which is a good thing about
Connecticut. That seems to be what's missing from that.
Cries from lawmakers. Two things. Roads aren't safe. Connecticut, and citizens too. You guys are saying this too, probably. The second part, that we pay too much to live in Connecticut. It's an expensive state to live, right? So these are things that the administration has tried to tackle this year. I want to start with that second piece. So I just talked about it with the governor. Susan, help me out here in talking about the impact of tax cuts. Do you think this is going to be a large impact? And mainly not just on the rank and file in Connecticut, I guess, or the people who normally benefit from tax cuts, but what about everybody else?
Well, I want to circle back.
Maybe with people under the Alice line.
I want to circle back with something you said. I mean, Connecticut has never been a bargain. It's never been an inexpensive state. We're in a tri-state area. This is a fair, but it's quality of life. And some would argue that. Let's start with that. So, but I think that the governor's attempt to make life more affordable, I mean, it's not a huge amount of money for people. However, it's something that hasn't been done in a very long time. And it's nice to give back to the state and to the people and the residents who pay taxes. So I believe that it also, we pay down debt. And I think that's very important as well. Republicans, for the first time, who usually call for less spending, wanted more tax cuts and paying down less debt. So I think it was a delicate balance. I think that people deserve some money back, and that's a good thing.
You guys have anything to say about taxes?
Connecticut's going to remain an expensive state, and you can only really work at the margins on tax relief. If you're talking about a broad-based tax cut, which is what the governor did. The governor chose to do that as opposed to do something more targeted, such as a child tax credit. They did increase the earned income tax credit, so that gave an added boost to lower income people. And the way the tax cut was structured, really the biggest impact is on singles who are making less than 50 grand and couples making less than 100.
And some low income, they don't pay working poor, right. They don't pay any taxes. So,
first part of that statement I said was that roads aren't safe. There's a lot of cries from citizens, from lawmakers that way. Two things they talked about, one that didn't get done in the session was talking about going from 0.08 to 0.05, 0.05 for the legal limit for alcohol, and of course the red light cameras that actually pass. So when are those tickets going to start coming in the mail for us that are running red lights or maybe speeding out there?
There's a local option on the cameras, and some of the communities are already moving forward, and so that will take time to roll out. I think those ultimately could have a greater impact than, you know, lowering the blood alcohol limit, because that still requires enforcement for the stops to be made. You know, the statistics are clear. The state police in particular, they're doing fewer traffic stops. There's different theories as to why that is. Some of that seem to date back to the passage of the police accountability law. But, you know, you all drove here, most of you, and, you know, I haven't seen a speed trap in a long time. And when I asked the colonel that, he corrected me, it's not speed traps, it's speed enforcement. But in any event, it's an issue.
I think what's unfortunate is that despite all the education and the awareness to drinking and driving, Connecticut remains one of the highest in the country with drunk driving fatalities. And I think a lot of us are saddened by that. Right. And it's not just young people. And in fact, Connecticut is, I think the budget included $20 million to put warning strips and signs for wrong way drivers. Right.
365 fatalities in 2022. That started the discussion.
Yeah. And that's already starting because those are not older people driving at 11 or 12 at night. Those are people who are driving under the influence. So from a state standpoint, I think it's important to do those things. But I think it's still very, very disheartening and sad that people continue to drink and drive. And that's not necessarily not a problem everywhere, but Connecticut has one of the worst problems in the country.
But I was going to say, Frank, I'm not overly enthusiastic about the cameras, though, especially in urban communities, which are, you know, over-policed, over-surveilled. And, you know, I think we need to think very carefully about what are the potential implications of this. And, you know, certainly dealing with this issue of people driving, you know, who have been drinking, for example, is a serious problem that does need to be addressed. But I think often when we do public policy, we don't think about the potential impact, especially with an equity lens attached to it. These things can often produce outcomes that we'll find will disproportionately impact communities of color and people who are poor. So I think we need to be very careful how we actually execute this particular law.
We talked about racial profiling in Weathersfield for a long time at Connecticut Public. It's something we covered. We did Collision Course, which was a documentary. And one of the things we found out while we were doing that reporting was that they were trying to put cameras up in town and on the border. And the police chief was telling everybody that they were going to be able to wire from C4 in Hartford, which is this albatross of cameras, and they were going to put it in Weathersfield and be able to, I guess, monitor the traffic there. So that's one thing that we followed. So that's an example of what Bilal Sekou is talking about here. Something that didn't, it came up this session, but it didn't get done. Inaction on affordable housing. It made a lot of people upset. There was a different word I was going to use there, but it made a lot of people upset. So where do we go next on affordable housing, and particularly in Fairfield County?
Well, they keep trying to create more incentives for cities and towns to do it, but they can't force them to do it, and I think that's the bottom line. Yeah.
There isn't the political will in the General Assembly or in the governor's office to take that on. That's been the case for quite some time. It's a small minority of lawmakers who are willing to vote on those kinds of measures. You know, you saw it in the gubernatorial election. Governor Lamont was not any more aggressive than Bob Stefanowski was, although Bob Stefanowski went further and he would have repealed, you know.
Why is there no political will, though? Who's like the, who is the opposition force, or maybe the boogeyman, as it were? Like, who's against it?
That gets, I think that gets very complicated. It goes to, you know, what people love about their communities. There's misapprehensions about what multifamily housing would mean, what affordable housing would mean. You know, this is nothing new, and you see it in all kinds of communities. But you know, the state could, as a matter of right, that zoning codes allow multifamily housing. Multifamily housing is only defined in Connecticut as 3 units or more, so you're not talking huge projects. But, you know, there are many communities that there is no allowance for multifamily housing at all. And it's, I don't know how you break that logjam politically. It's very difficult.
It's a land of study habits, I think, and people like the communities that they live in and worry that their property values may not be as valuable. It's like regionalization. A lot of talk has been done over the years to try to get communities to share certain services and that. But that's another conversation.
But, you know, people make those kinds of arguments, and they've always made those arguments about their worry about property values, their worry about the quality of schools. At the end of the day, what we know is that here in Connecticut, like many other parts of the country, but especially in the Northeast, zoning has been used in a very exclusionary way, which has basically created the hoarding of opportunity in the suburbs. And in central cities, we see the exact opposite of that. And so I think this really can be one of those issues that the governor can lead the country in a very good direction by really working with those local communities. And again, those conversations are difficult, but the opportunity to do, you know, having communities to build their fair share of affordable housing and giving access to people, because in a country in which we pride ourselves on the notion that people have rights and opportunity and options, the reality is income is a barrier, and suburbs create walls to keep people out. And in the process, it's a hoarding of opportunity,
but
and that's a problem.
Housing is so critical. If you look,
You got to clap there. The Wheelhouse Live. Thank you.
If you look at what's happening in Hartford now with all the new housing developments, and I believe a percentage of those new buildings that have come up are affordable units. That was part of the criteria for them to be built. You know, Hartford has struggled over the years to be a vibrant capital city. And now, because this component of people living there, we are seeing more businesses and restaurants opening on Pratt Street. So housing is critical. You can build all the amenities you want, but if you don't have people living there, it's not harmonious.
Hartford's still deleteriously, I just threw that word out there, sorry, impacted by what's happened in Fairfield County ages ago, and it still continues to wreak havoc on Hartford. I got to move on. Paz loves when I do this. I like to go to a lot of different topics and try to fit them in. So I'm going to give you guys 20 seconds each. Good luck. Mm-hmm. Bilal, I'll start with you. What's everybody going to be talking about in the next legislative session in Connecticut?
Well,
give me one thing that we'll be talking about.
I'm hoping that they'll be talking about no excuse absentee voting.
Ooh. Paz.
It's not a legislative issue. It's going to be on the ballot. So they got to do the Constitution. The zero emission vehicles, the failure to adopt those regulations, that's going to bleed into the next session. There were some hopes that they could do it special session before the regular session opens. I don't see any sign of that. So I think, you know, we're going to be hearing more about that.
I think they're going to try to roll out, certainly, early voting, you know, and make that seamless for the registrars of voters. But I agree with Mark. I think everybody wants a cleaner environment, and we have to move in that direction. I think what was unveiled was probably an overly ambitious plan because it didn't have infrastructure. So you can't tell everybody they're going to have an EV or a hybrid, but we don't really know where you're going to charge it or where the batteries are going to be in those recharge. So I think they all have to come together and figure out a plan going forward, but I think they'll do it.
That's it for Connecticut and 2023. 2024 is next in America and beyond. 2024, that's so close. You're listening to The Wheelhouse Live and our powerhouse panel.
You're listening to the new investigative reporting podcast, In Absentia, which means you're interested in getting to the facts and uncovering the truth. If you'd like to help us continue our investigative work, consider making a donation. Visit ctpublic.org/tapsupport and contribute today. That's ctpublic.org/tapsupport. Thank you for being a part of the Accountability Project.
If you've never donated to this station before, that's okay. Public radio is available to everyone for free. But we do rely on listener support from those who are able to give. So join the community of supporters for Public Media Giving Days. And thanks.
Give now at ctpublic.org/donate.
This is The Wheelhouse from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Frankie Graziano. The powerhouse panel is still here. Susan Raff, WFSB News Channel 3. I caught our live audience sleeping. We do have a live audience for this show. They are being awesome. They're giving us some cheers. They're really listening and following along with some of the content, so we appreciate that very much. Mark Pazniokas, Capitol Bureau Chief at the Connecticut Mirror, wearing a dazzling sport coat. Look at those buttons. I like to embarrass people. And Dr. Bilal Sekou, a great friend of mine, always looking good. Don't worry about being bald, you know. You rock it well. You look better than I do with hair, you know.
Of all the clothes on stage, he comments on my sports coat.
Yeah, don't look at my shoes. These are custom made, by the way. All right. So we are doing The Wheelhouse Live. As we said, we have a great audience today. We're so lucky to have it. We talked about 2023 in Connecticut. Let's go further. I want to talk about 2024 in the United States. And, of course, there's a big election coming up, and a lot has been made recently of poll numbers. We've had conversations, some of us, earlier on, but right now the poll numbers seem to indicate that former President Donald Trump may actually be ahead of Joe Biden by a couple of points. So help me, guys. Maybe I'll start with you, Bilal. Should we put some weight into these polls? Yeah, you're going to get the hard questions.
The easy start. I mean, it's a year out. Well, almost a year out. And so, you know, how much faith we can put into polls right now? Probably not a lot. Barack Obama was behind, you know, in the polls. And so, we've had numerous examples in the past where that's been the case. But at the same time, I remember having conversations with people back in 2016 who said, there's no way Donald Trump could win. And I was the one who would say, no, it's very possible that he can win. And so I think, you know, this is going to be a tough fight between now and then for on both sides. And so it'll be interesting to see how this all shakes out.
Paz, we talked a couple of months back about the president's age being a factor. For some reason, this is something that voters may care about. Is it perhaps that? Is it also recently we've been talking about we had the government shutdown conversation. There was negotiations. In one of the rounds of negotiations, you had Republicans talking about whether or not there should be funding for Israel and also for Ukraine. And then recently, Democrats were talking about whether or not to fund Israel because they were worried about civilians in Palestine. So just crystallizing this conversation, could that also impact the president, how people think about Israel and Palestine, as it has come up in the shutdown conversations? Can age impact the president?
Everything could impact it. I mean, we are on the edge of an unprecedented election in so many ways. So you have a Republican Party that's coming apart at the seams. You see that in the struggles to have a Speaker of the House who has the authority to actually run the House. You have the front runner for the nomination who is facing...
Stick with Biden, though. We'll get to... We're going to get there in a second.
It's all intertwined. And so the Republican conduct of the Congress, you know, the question of will the money, for example, for the Ukraine go away? That's a very real possibility right now.
Ends at the end of the year, yeah.
And so, sure, you have the issue of Biden's age, but also Trump's. I mean, Trump is turning 78. Trump will be on the ballot older than Ronald Reagan was when he left office. People forget that. Everybody was freaked out by the age of Ronald Reagan, and now it's like, you know, he was youthful compared to Biden and Trump.
Susan, are we putting the obituary together here for Joe Biden's next term? What do you think? Is he still have a chance? Are we talking too much about poll numbers here early
on? I just think this is a difficult election for a lot of people, yeah. Right? I think there are a lot of people who don't really want to vote for either candidate, right? And in the end, you have to vote for somebody if you feel like you are, you know, a voter. There are people, even Republicans, who are worried about what another Trump presidency will be like. Do you agree with Liz Cheney, who believes that democracy will be threatened? Do you vote for Biden, who obviously is older, and worried that he will carry out his presidency? I think this is a very, very difficult election. I think we are polarized in this country, the rhetoric and anger. And I'm a little bit concerned about what the next few months are going to be like.
I want to ask you specifically about, I'm going to ask you guys about apathy in a second. But before we get there, an ultra-conservative agenda. Locally, we saw, and I talk to Paz about this all the time, about hyper-local versus local or national, whether it matters or not. But we had in Connecticut a candidate that was arrested for participating in the January 6th insurrection. Right. You also then had, he lost in November. You also had Killingly board members that had this, I will say, ultra-conservative agenda. They lost. In national politics, maybe an issue like abortion comes up, reproductive rights. So can an ultra-conservative agenda win a national election?
Not a national election, I don't think so. But again, when we think about a presidential election, there are 50 states. And then if you think about all of the different local communities, we're talking about something that is very disaggregated. And what can happen here in Connecticut, what doesn't play here in Connecticut may play in another state, right? And so the way to sort of look at this is that Connecticut is not a place where you will have that kind of history and deep-rooted sort of conservatism that you may see in a place like Georgia or Alabama or Mississippi or further out in the Midwest. And so some of those issues don't play as well here. We haven't had a real groundswell for book banning. We haven't had a real groundswell for some of the other cultural, social-cultural issues that resonate with voters in other states. But I will say this about the Biden thing very quickly, is that there was a poll just came out about young people. And I think if there is an Achilles heel for the president, it's that while young people are not monolithic, whenever I bring up the election of 2024 to my students, they almost want to run me out with pitchforks, right? They are not excited about either of the candidates. They're not excited about me going to the polls, some of them for the very first time, and having those two candidates as their choices.
All right.
But at this point, we don't have any other options for them.
So put your common cause.
And they
cause.
May stay home, which is really what the problem
so
is.
So put your common cause hat on. Yeah. Now how do we engage to avoid voter apathy, I guess? What are advocates going to be talking about?
I don't think we have enough time to find two better candidates. So in the meantime, between now and then, I think we've got to really place a heavy emphasis on civic education. We've got to talk to young people about the importance of voting, right? Because at the end of the day, and as I always say to them, the first time you cast that vote, you know, at 18, for example, you are building the habit that in 2 years will bring you back to the polls. Voting is habit forming, and starting young people early, getting them to vote is really important. So I think it's critical that both parties do a lot of work to turn out people. It puts a lot of pressure on states also to do that kind of public education and turn out the young people. Universities need to do their part, and we will be doing our part in the fall. But that needs to be a real effort if we're going to really save our democracy.
Paz, Susan, right now a poll might say something about Donald Trump, but the former president also has four indictments that he's dealing with. I don't know whether or not Nikki Haley may get more support in the future, as it looks like the Koch network is backing her up. They backed up Trump in 2016 and 2020, I believe. So I don't know. I'm kind of grasping at straws.
The
better question is, I guess, can Donald Trump still have the standing a year from now?
Okay, take all polls right now with a huge grain
of salt.
That's
what I'm saying. So get me there. Yeah.
There are so many there's so many dynamics at work here. It's really hard to know. Some of it will be what pollsters struggle with is trying to figure out who actually will be the electorate in any election. It shifts from time to time. Will young people turn out or not? That affects the reliability of polls in a very big way. We saw that in 2012, where Republican pollsters all had very different numbers on Barack Obama and Mitt Romney, because the assumption was there would be a regression to what was sort of the norm, which is a smaller number of young voters and a smaller number of black voters turning out. Well, it turned out to not be the case, that black voters and young voters turned out in the same numbers in 2012 as they did in 2008. But again, there's a lot that's going to happen between now and then. The Democrats have not really started focusing on Trump, and the fact that there is so much concern, even among Republicans I talk to, as to who would populate another Trump White House. President Trump had enough problems the first time, but the feeling is, okay, who would work in that White House the next time? And that's, you know, that's, these themes will be developed over the course of the next year, but they take time.
I got Paz hotter than these lights on stage here. I love getting a little bit of a butt whoop in there and an education. Thank you.
And it's not just young people, it's independents. You know, those voters, which comprise the largest voting bloc in our state and others, you know, where do they go, and how do those voters feel about taking the responsibility to who to vote for? There's a lot of time, but I think people know now how they feel, but it's going to be, I think it's going to be a bumpy road.
In the last couple of minutes of the show, I'll give you guys a little more time than I did in the previous segment, where I gave you like 20 seconds. So maybe a minute to 90 seconds each, something like that. One for the road. One thing we didn't talk about tonight that we're going to be talking about a year from now. I will start with Susan Raff.
I'm going to talk about the hate speech that we've been seeing on college campuses across this country. Anti-Semitism and Islamophobia. And the governor is trying to set the tone by having his new state police commissioner meet with college presidents to talk about security. I think, and I agree with Antony Blinken, that we are going to see that rhetoric really increase and explode on college campuses and in our communities. And we have to find a way to work together to allow people to have free speech, but to keep our communities safe.
Follow that, Paz.
I can't. If Donald Trump is the nominee, I think what will be one of the things we'll be talking about is the future of the Republican Party in Connecticut specifically, and in the Northeast in general. The Republicans, until the election of Donald Trump, actually had done quite well in making a comeback from the debacle of 2008, when they won only 37 of the 151 seats in the state house. And then they pulled within four or five seats of a majority in 2016. And they had a tie in the Senate. And then it all went to hell after that, really because of how Trump mobilized a Democratic electorate to turn out in incredible numbers in 2018 and again in 2020.
As a college professor, I'll stick to that theme of higher ed. I work at an institution that, you know, when I was a student back in 1984, I would not have been able to afford to go to college there. You know, fortunately, I went at a time where my Pell Grant covered much of my tuition and room and board. And that Pell Grant has not increased that much in value since the 1980s.
I'm a recipient.
Right. I think we have a real crisis in our country now with higher ed. The costs are going so high that it is becoming increasingly unaffordable for working class and poor people to actually be able to complete a college degree and then come out and not have a mountain of debt that they'll be paying off for decades. I think we need to have that conversation about how we get much more federal and state support for higher ed. I think we need to talk more seriously about how we even talk about the trades and other things, because college is not necessary for everyone. So hopefully in the next year, we can have candidates who will have that conversation, which could potentially engage young people in this next election.
When we wanted to do the Wheelhouse Live, we promise you, this is Meg Dalton that came up with this title, our producer of our show, a powerhouse panel. Did we give you a powerhouse panel? Susan Raff, WFSB Eyewitness News, Channel 3. Mark Pasniokas, the Connecticut Mirror, and Dr. Bilal C. Koo, University of Hartford. Thank you so much to them. Thank you so much to Governor Ned Lamont and his team for coming on the show. What a tremendous show we had today. It was produced by Meg Dalton. Executive producer is my boss, Katie Tolarski, who's also here today. Thank you, Katie. Helping us direct the live show, we had Joe Koss and Bradley O'Connor. Floor directors, Megan Boone. Also, special thanks to Megan Fitzgerald, who helped out as well. Special thanks to all those who helped us put this together, including Lucy Nalpathanchel. Some of the live audience members got to meet her earlier. Thank you so much to Lucy, Lauren Komrosky, Jessica Ganella, of course, our audience and engagement team that we have here at Connecticut Public. So thank you so much to Lucy and the team. Much love to Sabrina Herrera, who works in social media at Connecticut Public to help get 75 people in here. Most of all, thank you to all of you. Right. 75 people paid for a ticket to come and see The Wheelhouse Live. I am so heartened. Thank you from the bottom of my Italian heart. Thank you for listening to The Wheelhouse, a special recap edition. Happy holidays.